Session number 11105, Colonel M. McBain, Reel 21.
After the staff college situation, where did you go to after that, Colonel?
Well, I finished off my staff tour in headquarters, 1st Division, and then was posted to rejoin the 1st Battalion, who by that time are in Hong Kong. And that gives an indication, of course, of the great joy of Army life in those days, moving around the world. Which sadly is gone, or is going. And so, after a bit of leave at home, off we went to Hong Kong, which was a nightmare journey, but we got there eventually. And to my great joy, I was given command of C Company again, the company I'd left in Berlin. Of course, by this stage, we were a regular army, and so most of the heroes in C Company were still there. And they were very kind enough to give me a great welcome back, so that was nice. Hong Kong, the battalion had been there for a year to 18 months before I joined them. And so they considered themselves old Hong Kong hands by this time. We were actually living in Kowloon on the mainland. They'd obviously had a slightly difficult time, I think, in that Kowloon is the original concrete jungle and is full of bars and all the rest of the things that go on, and not the best place in the world to put 600-700 Geordies, and they used to get themselves into trouble, apparently, or had done. So I was quite pleased when, again, the battalion was too big to all live in the barracks in Kowloon, and so it had a detachment of support company and a rifle company out of Kowloon in a place called Erskine Camp. And there was the new territories, of course, in Hong Kong. During the Korean War had been very much in a state of war, really, because they expected the Chinese to pour across that border, as they had done in Korea. And so there were a lot of camps and defensive positions and so on up in the new territories. Erskine Camp was one such place. It was a Nissen Hattic camp that had been allowed to decay to some extent. And so the rifle support company lived there permanently with its support weapons and so on. And the rifle companies, the three rifle companies, rotated through it for, I think, a couple of months at a time. And just after I'd got there, it was C Company's turn to go out to Erskine. And so off we went. And I suppose, thinking about it, it's probably about 10 miles out. But I mean, it was the most perfect place. It was on top of a hill overlooking the South China Sea, and very close to the battalion speedboats and motorboats. And again, it was a bit like Egypt, where I'd been very lucky as a support platoon commander, where I'd been left pretty much on my own to do what I wanted to. Well, out there, as a company commander, within reason, you were able to get on with your own life. It's the usual thing, of course, you get away from battalion headquarters and you're laughing. The officers, I was obviously married and accompanied. I was living in married quarters in Kowloon. All the other officers were single and lived in Erskine Camp. In, I suppose, by UK standards, fairly primitive conditions in Nissen huts, but really not bad. And to a young lad of 21 and so on, looking out your bedroom window at the South China Sea, not bad. And so there we were, and whatever the period of time was, 2 or 3 months, it was approaching a time when we would have to go back into Kowloon, into the barracks. When, to my delight, my old mate John Arnott, who's come out of A Company, I don't know where we were. At home, we were all in the same block of married quarters, flats. We were talking. And John and I had shared a tent in Egypt for 2 years, we knew one another very well. But I never really understood John. At some stage, he asked me, was there any chance of me staying in Erskine? Because he did want to stay in Gun Club, because he wanted to do the Queen's birthday parade. Well, that was the last thing I wanted, and I'm sure it was the last thing C Company wanted. So I said, well, I'm delighted. I mean, you go and see old Flubber. Flubber was the commanding officer, Leslie Fleming. Go and see him and ask him. I'm quite happy. In fact, I asked the boys, what do you think? Because for the soldiers, it was a bit of a long way out, but we'd got ourselves sorted out, and they didn't seem to mind too much. The main thing was they were out of the RSM site and regimental policemen and all that sort of thing. And so between us, we decided, yeah, we'd be quite happy to stay in Erskine. And blow me, that was agreed. Whether Leslie Fleming didn't want C Company back under his will, I don't know. Anyway, so we stayed there for the whole time, which was marvellous. We never went back into Gun Club. And we were exercising, and it was fairly soon, I think, after I got there that we were told we were going to go to Borneo, where the counterinsurgency operations were in hand against the Chinese, Indonesian people who thought they might take over Sarawak and Sabah. So we'd been summoned to the help of the Malaysian government. And that had been going on for a while, of course. And we were going to get, while we were in Hong Kong, battalions were coming out from UK and were doing some training in the new territories. Prior to going into Borneo, and our predecessors, the people we took over from ultimately in Borneo, one RGJ, Royal Green Jackets, it wasn't the 1st Battalion, it was the 2nd Battalion Green Jackets. They came through Hong Kong. And we always got on very well with the Green Jackets, and we had them in to dinner and so on. They then went off to Borneo to do their year, and eventually we discovered we were going to take over from them when we went down. There wasn't an awful lot of training we could do in Hong Kong other than fitness training and marching up and down hills and that sort of thing. So eventually the families all went home, and we went off to Sabah to do some, Sabah which is North Borneo, to do some pre-operational jungle training.
Did your experience in Malaya kind of give you support in this?
Oh, yes. I mean, I knew where I was going, although jungle does vary. In fact, the Borneo jungle was more, sounds a bit strange, was easier than the Malay jungle. The Malayan jungle was nasty. The Borneo jungle, primary jungle, which is the original jungle before anyone's got at it, in the part of Borneo we were in, was really quite user-friendly compared to Malaya. It was just great big jungle giants, trees, And of course, if you get those growing, not a lot can grow underneath. And so underneath is fairly clear. And it was all fairly level. It wasn't completely level, but fairly level. So we went off. Again, three rifle companies went by sea, which was nice. We crossed the South China Sea in Sir Lancelot, which was a landing ship logistics, which hit the press a lot later on in the Falklands when Galahad and various others were burnt and bombed. Lancelot took us across the South China Sea to Jesselton, as it was called then. It's now called Kota Kinabalu. Kinabalu is the highest mountain in Southeast Asia, I think. Anyway, it's a big mountain, and it's in North Borneo, in Sabah. And we were going to a training area at Kota Balud, it was called. And it, again, it's one of the sort of strange things that the British Army does from time to time. Kota Balud had been chosen because to train Gurkha battalions in Hong Kong in Western European type warfare. And so there weren't a lot of trees. And in fact, it was great open pampas land, really, with, believe it or not, cowboys driving herds of cattle. And so, all right, we went there, but it did mean we had to drive considerable distances to find any trees to pretend we were in the jungle. But we did. And we were living in this little camp called Paradise Camp, which again, nowadays, I suppose people would pay a lot of money to go and spend the holidays in a place like that. You could sit outside our little, again, I was sharing with Arnott. Arnott and I seemed to be drawn like magnets, sharing accommodation. John and I were sharing this tin hut. And we would sit outside in our sarongs, having showered in the evening, and there was Mount Kinabalu in the distance. Good old colonial stuff. And the training, yes, I mean, because of Malaya, I was able to get C Company G'd up a bit, and we knew roughly what we were doing or trying to do. There wasn't a lot for anyone to do in Kota Balud, really, when we weren't training. The only slightly strange thing was the locals did play a very strange form of polo. And they had these little ponies, which were native to Borneo. And inevitably, some of our more senior officers who fancied themselves as polo players, they played in Egypt and various other places. Somehow or other, there was a game of polo arranged, or whatever passed as polo. That was hilarious. All these little men turned up in their little ponies, and our heroes, their feet were touching the ground most of the time. These ponies, in fact, strangely enough, in those days and still today, Hong Kong was the centre of the Chinese film industry, or the free Chinese film industry. There were big film studios in Hong Kong, and they were always making epics about Genghis Khan and the Tartar hordes and all the rest of it. And they needed a lot of little ponies for that. And they used to get these beasts from Borneo. And in fact, in Hong Kong, the battalion had been playing polo in Hong Kong, because when the film people had finished Genghis Khan, or the son of Genghis Khan, or whatever it was they'd been making, they would say to the British Army, "Would you like these little ponies to look after them when we're going to make the second son of King Kong, we'll get them back again." But in Kota Balud, they were used by the locals they were cowboys, these herds of cattle. So that was interesting. And of course, the soldiers, it was interesting in the jungle. The Borneo jungle is very good for butterflies. Lots of beautiful butterflies, big ones and little ones, very bright coloured ones. So that was that. Kota Balud was suppose about 80 miles in from Jesselton, which was the port.
Were there any health problems in that climate?
No, because the battalion was fairly well acclimatised, you see, having been in Hong Kong for 18 months. They were used to humidity and beasties and insects and so on. So, no, there was no great health problem. The only thing that we'd been warned about was in streams and rivers you could get leptospirosis, I think it's called, which is the result of rats peeing in the water, and then if you had an open cut or scratch and the water got in, that could cause you pretty severe problems, and leptospirosis was not pleasant, and in fact, unless it was caught quickly, it did you. But that was the only noticeable thing that we were told to look out for. I mean, it's all very well saying look out for it, but you know, if you're plodging through the jungle, you get scratched, and you've got to go through streams at least three times a day. So, what you're supposed to do, I'm not quite sure. However, we were lucky, and the battalion did have some cases, two or three, I think, but they all survived. What else happened at Côte de Blood? Sadly, a soldier was drowned. Someone was doing a river crossing, some training, because we knew there was going to be a lot of water where we were. Somebody was doing crossing rivers, practicing crossing rivers, and a soldier sadly died, which upset him for a bit. But that was that. And at some stage towards the end of our stay in Côte de Blood, the company commanders, three rifle company commanders and one or two other heroes went on a recce to the area where we were going to take over. And as I say, we would in fact knew we were taking over from 2nd Green Jackets, who we had seen in Hong Kong, and I, to my pleasure, was told I was taking over from their B company, which was being run by one Mike Carlton Smith, who I had known at Sandhurst and at Warminster, and he in fact had been a grade 2 staff officer in Germany when I was a grade 3 staff officer, and was one of the brighter stars in the Green Jacket firmament, and the Green Jackets had quite a lot of stars in their firmament on and off. And so I was very glad. So we went down there and we were met. We flew down to Kuching and we drove in from Kuching and were met there. And it was a very easy recce because, as I say, we always got on well with the Green Jackets. We the Durham Light Infantry, had a similar, what we used to call a light approach thing. I mean, we took everything very seriously, but we didn't make very heavy weather of it. An example of that was this recce party. When we got to Kuching, we were met by, I think he was the operations officer, 2RDJ, and there were Land Rovers there to take us into the town headquarters. And we were each, without any sort of stupidity or anything, we were just each given a rifle and some ammunition, because anything could have happened between the airfield and the battalion headquarters, because there was a war going on, because of course we'd had to fly down in a civilian aircraft from Jesselton to Kuching, so we were in civilian clothes and unarmed. We had our uniforms and so on with us. But they just, said, by the way, there's a rifle in a magazine, just take it with you, and so off we went. And we spent, I suppose it was a week, in our jungle bases, or the places that were going to be our jungle bases, with the Green Jackets. And then went back, Finished off the bits of training with a final exercise. Each company did an exercise. And then we went down and took over from the Green Jackets.
What was the situation in Borneo that you found?
Well, what had happened was the Chinese all over the Far East, you know, they will never ever give their sole loyalty to the country they're living in. They are always Chinese, and they are always looking to the motherland. However long they've been wherever they are, it was the same in Malaya. I mean, Chinese in Malaya have been there for generations, but they were still Chinese as opposed to Malayan. Okay, they call themselves Malayan Chinese, but you know they were Chinese. And this is their problem all over the Far East, because they are the people, wherever you go in the Far East, they are the people with the money and the commercial know-how and so on. They run the economies of the country, whatever people may think. Well, the Malays, of course, don't like this. And at this stage, Sarawak and Sabah were part of Malaysia. It had become Malaysia, and indeed Singapore was part of Malaysia, but Singapore eventually split away. And the Malays in Sarawak started to try to impose the same preferential treatment for the Malays and the locals over the Chinese, and that, of course, again is obviously a very ripe breeding ground for discontent. And the Indonesians, who rather fancied the whole of Borneo, not just the bit they had, encouraged this, with the result that a whole load of Chinese, mainly Chinese, some Indians, mainly Chinese, went across into the Indonesian bit of Borneo to be trained and armed and sent back in to cause mayhem in Sarawak. And as I say, this has been going on for, I suppose, a couple of years before we got there. And again, by the time we got there, I mean, it was still going on. But our main function was to maintain the integrity of the frontier between Indonesia and Borneo and Sarawak. And so the jungle bases, which were company bases, were dotted along the frontier. And our job was to stop incursions from Indonesia and Borneo.
And were these strategically placed on routes across the border?
Well, of course, you again, in Borneo, you had the classic colonial situation. I mean, the border was some lines drawn on a map by a couple of colonial wizards in the 1860s or 70s. and it bore no relation to geography or inhabitants. It was just a straight line on a map. Or there were very few maps, of course. I mean, I started when we were there. Some of the maps were the original Dutch colonial maps of 1890, and there wasn't a lot on them because a lot of it was unexplored. During the incursion, during this thing, the RAF took a lot of pictures, and they had started producing maps, but of course producing maps of the jungle is not easy, because you take an aerial photograph, fine, and all you get then is what looks like an enlarged photograph of a cauliflower. And you occasionally see bits of river. You might occasionally be able to discern a hill or a feature, but by and large it's... So maps were a bit vague. But the frontier, as I say, it was a completely impartial line drawn on a map. But yes, the jungle bases were along that frontier, or they were, I suppose, on average 2 or 3 miles back into Sarawak from the frontier. and they were used as patrol bases up to the frontier. Most of them were near or pretty close to a native settlement, a longhouse. The natives lived in longhouses, usually on a river or a stream. And the whole thing was done by helicopter. Otherwise, you'd have spent days going around from A to B. The river, some of the rivers were navigable. People did tiddle around a bit on those with boats. But the forward bases were helicopter, completely helicopter supplied and so on, supported. So, as I say, we turned up eventually in Kuching and then up into our jungle bases. I'm now thinking very hard about how we got from Jesselton to Kuching. You know, for the life of me, I can't think. I can only assume we flew. Yeah, we must have flown, but it doesn't register at all. We eventually got to Kuching anyway, and in from Kuching to battalion headquarters, which was a series of little wooden huts with atap. Atap is a sort of palm leaf thatch roof. This was battalion headquarters, and we went in by chopper from there. I, in fact, had gone, obviously, with an advance party. So we certainly flew. Did the battalion move by boat? Doesn't matter. I'd flown down with the advance parties, and I'd then gone in to my base. So I was in Nibong, Fort Nibong. Actually, it wasn't called Fort Nibong. We called it Fort Nibong. And eventually the heroes arrived, and as a helicopter load of Geordies came in, a helicopter load of Green Jackets went out. And eventually we were left as sole occupants of the place. I say sole occupants, not true. I think very unusually, and they didn't like it very much, but each of these bases had one gun, a light gun. And this, our gunner battery was in fact a Marine Commando battery. And so our guns in each of the company bases, three company bases, were run by Marine gunners, green, light green berries. So they were there with us. And that was very good. I mean, that was great. They'd been there with the Green Jackets. And they used to rotate the gun crew as opposed to the whole thing. But while I was there, the GPO, the gun position officer, was in fact the regimental sergeant major of the Marine Commando Gunner Regiment. He's a great man, nice man. And we got on very well together.
What was his name?
Knight, from memory. He was eventually commissioned, I understand, but then sadly died, I'm told. But we got on very well together. The other unusual thing about Nibong was I also had two 4.2-inch mortars, which were a prehistoric World War II weapon. They'd been used in Korea. We'd had them in Korea behind us, and the Royal Artillery used them. They were considered too big and clever for the infantry, so it was always the Royal Artillery who used them. But I mean, they'd been obsolete since World War II. They resurrected them for Korea, and even in, I mean, that was 1952, whenever it was. They were pretty erratic then. Well, this was 1965. And I felt very sorry for these gunners. There were two of them, and they were manned by, in turn, in rotation, by gunners from the Light Air Defense Regiment that was guarding Kuching Airport. And they used to change over and come up for a bit of life on the Simi side. And again, what was interesting, at one stage, the gun position officer for the 4.2 mortars, who were at the other end of the base, was the battery sergeant major of the battery from Kuching Airfield. That battery sergeant major had taught the RSM of the gun all he knew about gunnery on some course at Lark Hill. So they knew one another very well. So it was really great fun. But we all felt sorry for the poor old mortars, because God knows where they got them from. And the ammunition, goodness knows where it come out of a hole in the ground in Singapore, I think. But